My name's Sam Anders. I'm an alcoholic and drug addict. Hey, everybody. The guy that's going to speak tonight, he and I'm, it's more like a family thing. He and I've known each other and had a relationship for now over 25 years. And I watched Smitty get his 25th year chip this year. Smitty was one of the original alumni, and back then there was, I asked Smitty a while ago, I said, how many of us were there then? I said, we got about 80 active people now, about 125 on the road. He said, about eight. And that's true. We were having the dances in here, and the Alumni Association was more of a dream. But Smitty came here, and Smitty got sober, and we were real small, and it was family. It truly was. There was maybe 8 or 10. Mary Jean and Perry were getting ready to come in, but I don't think y'all were here yet. But they were out preparing to come to Ridgeview and did an extremely excellent job. But this guy that's speaking tonight, I went to a wedding about, 24 years ago, I think. And the two greatest things that, well, Smitty's accomplished a lot of things in his life, boy, when he's drunk. He had a career going then, and I think still has that career going. The best thing you ever do other than getting sober. Lisa, stand up, sugar. Is somehow, Lisa don't drink that much, but apparently she got real drunk, and Smitty hemmed her up, and she married him. I happened to witness that thing that day, and that's been, they're celebrating their 24th anniversary in September. This is a success story, you know, and it's a personal success story for me, since I love Smitty and Lisa. And all that much, and we see each other every week in a particular meeting we go to. So when we were looking for a speaker, some of us got together and thought about Smitty. And I've read his medical record, so you know I may doze off from time to time, but for those of you, the rest of you, you will not take a nap tonight. This is my very good friend and brother, Smitty. His name is Robert Smith.
My name is Smitty Smith, and I'm an addict. When I'm in AA meetings, I'm an alcoholic. When I'm in NA meetings, I'm an addict. When I'm in CA meetings, I'm an addict, alcoholic. You can call me whatever you want tonight. But I'm grateful to be here tonight, and I'm very emotional. I was just talking with Tom and Patty Scott just a bit ago, and just very emotional. You know, I'm excited, I'm happy, and you know, this is kind of where it all began. Not my using, but the end of my using. And that's not what I came here for. You know, I came here because my job said, if you don't go there, then you don't have to worry about coming back here again. And so I was given that ultimatum, and through a series of events that took place, and I wound up in this place. I'm a graduate of Ridgeview, class of 1988. Ridgeview still had dirt roads back then, and the general store was over here, I think it was. But this place has really done a lot. I was telling Tom, I was traveling some years ago, and I was actually out on the West Coast, and I went to a meeting, and I was talking to a guy, and he was asking where I was from, and I said I was from the Atlanta area. He said, really? He said, I went to treatment there. I said, really, where'd you go? He said, Ridgeview Institute. And so Ridgeview has an incredible, you know, reputation of helping people and being there. And I know for a period of time, a lot of treatment centers were going through a lot of issues, you know, with the economy and that kind of thing. So I'm very grateful that Ridgeview was able to maintain and stay the course, because this place holds a lot for a lot of people. And Sam was right, when the Alumni Association got started, there weren't a bunch of us. We were sitting around a table one day just telling war stories, and we kind of talked Sam into trying to do something like that. And, you know, it was pretty half-hearted effort, actually, but it kind of morphed into something. And so what I see going on now, and I know it's been going on for years, it's just pretty amazing. And I know a lot of people have been lent a lot of support by what goes on with the Alumni Association today. So I'm very grateful just had any kind of participation in it. So you guys are very fortunate, because a lot of institutions don't support the recovering community the way Ridgeview does, and I'm very grateful for that. I see a lot of people in here that I know and I love so much, and it's just absolutely amazing. I see a lot of my friends from NA, I see a lot of my friends from CA, a lot of my friends from AA, and it's just amazing, because the recovering community is just that. You know, I know we have our preferences about which meetings we go to, but at the end of the day, we just are recovering people, and we just want to live the best way we can. And, you know, and I know we have to respect whatever 12-step meeting we're in, and I do that, you know. But tonight I just want to just talk about recovery, you know, a little bit. I'm very, very grateful. I'm an Atlanta native. How many Atlanta natives in the room tonight? That's amazing. I'm a Grady baby. And that may not mean a lot to a lot of people, but I was born at Grady Hospital in 1960. And I was educated in Atlanta. I graduated from Frederick Douglass High School. I attended Morehouse College. So I've been in the area for a very, very long time. And so I know this town like the back of my hand. And I made sure I got very familiar with it, particularly the west side of town. Adamsville area, West End area, Midtown area. Those were my places I did of pharmaceutical transactions. And yeah. And you know, just amazing today to see the city change the way it does, and I'm very grateful to kind of see it through a different set of eyes today. But Sam mentioned my wife today, and Lisa, we spent a lot of time up here. We were coming across the parking lot on the way in, and she said, "You know, babe, we spent a lot of time up here at Ridgeview." I said, "Yeah, we sure did." And a lot of our friends that we still hold very near and dear to us today, we met them through Ridgeview, you know, and just, you know, being amongst the recovering community. And I'm very grateful. I'm thankful, man. I come from a very, very long line of prestigious drunks. My great-grandfather was an alcoholic, and he lost his life to this disease. My grandfather was a horrible alcoholic, and at some point he was able to arrest his disease, but he didn't do it through this means. And my father was a real bad alcoholic, and he used the agency of the church to kind of deal with his disease, but at the end, you know, he was an untreated alcoholic. And so here I am, the fourth generation of Smiths to come, and I think at some point God decided that the madness needed to stop. And he created some situations in my life that necessitated me getting some help. A lot of times that help was against my desire to really want help. I kind of was enjoying the life I was leading at the time. I was single and I was free, and I loved booze and I loved cocaine. And nobody could tell me that this was not the life. I had no idea the price I was going to have to pay years later for having those loves of my life, and never knew the turmoil it was going to cause to my family and my friends and my relationships and my career, because I just wanted to have a good time. I didn't bank on all the situations and the repercussions and the issues I was going to have to deal with as a result of my disease, because I didn't know I had a disease. I just knew I liked to drink. I liked to party and I liked to have fun. And at some point that thing boomeranged on me and it came back and it cut me to shreds. And I didn't learn anything about my disease until I got to this place. And people who were honest enough with me and people who were candid and frank enough with me to let me know if I continued down this path, then my end was not going to be very pleasant. And so through a series of events, you know, I started drinking heavily when I was in high school, but I had my first drink when I was 8 years old. My parents used to be members of a social club, and after their club meetings, they would let my brothers and I clean up, help them clean up the room from the club meetings. Well, they were drinking at these meetings, and so our job was to take the paper cups off the table, take them to the kitchen, pour the what was in the sink, and put the cups in the trash can. That's all we had to do. Pick up the cups, pour them in the sink, put them in the trash. I took a shortcut. I took the cup off the table, poured it down my throat, put it in the trash can. And one night I got a good swig of somebody's Tanqueray. And I don't know if I was drunk that night. I just know that my mother chastised me for drinking what was in that cup and told me never to do that again. But of course, the next club meeting, I did that again. And I continued to drink through high school and into college. I didn't know how much fun college could be, particularly in the Atlanta University Center, where you have four or five different universities all together. And Morehouse College at the time was a wonderful party school. They trained a lot of good men, but they trained a lot of drunks too. And I did my due up there on that campus for a while. I'll never forget, I had been misbehaving badly on campus, and I got called into the president's office. President at the time was Mr. Hugh Gloucester, and Mr. Gloucester and me and a couple of other gentlemen were being taken to task for our behavior, not only on Morehouse's campus, but on Spelman College's campus. Spelman was the girls' school across the street. And we got called to his office about some behavior that he felt was unseemly of a Morehouse man, and proceeded to take us to task about that and asked me, had I ever thought about Alcoholics Anonymous? Well, all I knew about AA is I thought it was a towing service, and I didn't need my car towed. My using, of course, progressed, and I was looking to go into a career in radio at the time, and I was a communications major at Morehouse. I began working my junior year at the college radio station, and was having a really good time, but it was a difficult situation because I was trying to study at night and go to school the next day. The shift I worked at the radio station was from midnight to 4 o'clock in the morning. I had 8 o'clock classes. And so one friend of mine made a wonderful suggestion to try and help me. He said, well, if you try cocaine, it'll help keep you up at night. And you can study and do your work and get to class on time. And it worked for about a week, you know. And I liked doing cocaine more than I did going to college. And so that quickly ended my Morehouse College career. I had an opportunity for a nice radio job once in New Orleans, and they were taking some interviews for some people for a job that was opening in New Orleans, and I had secured an interview for one of the slots, and it was me and another young lady from over at Spelman, and they were gonna pick who they wanted, and on the day of my interview, I got drunk and never showed up for the interview. And that's the kind of stuff when I talk about how my addiction and my alcoholism took from me. Nobody ever put a gun to my head and made me drink booze. Nobody ever put a gun to my head and made me snort cocaine. Nobody ever put a gun to my head and made me smoke pot. I did it all willingly, and sometimes I was the initiator of the using. So I did it, and I had to deal with the consequences behind it too. And it continued to take from me. I like what it did, but it continued to take from me. I like what I felt, but it continued to steal from me. I like, you know, the closeness I felt, but it continued to tear my family apart, my relationships, all my initiative, all that stuff was kind of put on the back burner so I could go get high. And it became paramount in my life that I do this because I began not to be able to even function at all without being high. And I still liked it. You know, I secured a job with the transit system in Atlanta in 1982. and you know, started a career there, and my using continued with me, and series of events led up to me coming to this place in 1988. The company I was working for had a problem with you riding around in their company vehicles drunk. I don't understand it, you know, and they took issue with it, and I wound up having to go talk to the people who handle all the people who are having substance abuse issues at work, and I went up to talk to this guy, and he said, well, we've talked to some of your bosses at work, and they think you might have a problem, and they want to send you to a place so you can get some help. And I said, nah, I think I'm in good shape. You know, I think I'm okay. They say, well, you know, if you ever do, we'd like for you to come back and talk to us, and, you know, we'll be willing to see about getting you some help. And I, at the time, was in great denial, and I just really did not like what he was talking about, not one bit. And continued to use, and had a couple other situations, some legal stuff and some work stuff go on, and I was separated from my job because of it. They had suspicion that I'd been using again, and so they sent me down for a drug test. The company I was working for at the time had a policy where if you came forward and you told them you were having substance abuse issues, they would get you some help. But if the situation came up and they had reasonable suspicion and took you down, then you were subject to termination. And so that was the deal. I had to go down for this big drug test, and I was just concerned about what kind of drugs they wanted me to test, you know. And I went down, and, you know, they took some blood, and they made me blow into a thing, and they told me I was suspended until the test results came back. I said, okay. And so I continued to get high for that 10 days, and I remember getting a phone call from work, and they're saying, well, your test results are back. We need you to come into the office so we can discuss, you know, what our next move is going to be. And so I came back to the office that day, and there was the manager of my department and the director of my department, and they had one of the you know, people who handle those situations there in the office, and he pulled out a big list. They say, well, Smitty, these are the results of your test. You know, we found out at the time you blew into this thing, you blew drunk. In your system, they found cocaine, Fruit Loops, shoe polish, Clorox, everything. And we think you got a problem. And we're going to send you down, and we're going to send you to treatment, and we will consider giving you your job back upon your successful completion of a 30-day in-house drug rehabilitation program. And they lost me at in-house. You know, I didn't hear anything else, you know. And I said, and if my answer is no, he said, well, this is the separation of our term of your employment right now. And I really kind of needed that job because that was the way I kind of financed my cocaine, you know. And so I said, okay, I'll do it. And they say, well, great, this is what we're going to do. He had all these beautiful pamphlets of all these great treatment centers around the country. There's a place in Colorado where I could have gotten sober under the Colorado mountains. And there's a place in Arizona I could have gotten sober in the desert. And there's a place in California I could have gotten sober on the beach. And I chose Smyrna. And it's close to home, you know. And so they told me, okay, well, we're going to call this place and we'll see if they got a bed for you. And they called a place, and of course there was a bed here. And I looked over the pamphlet at Ridgeview, and the first thing I saw was a swimming pool. I was like, yeah, you know. Of course, it was November then. So we made a deal. I had to be out here November 20th, 1988 at 6 o'clock. The guy told me, if you're there at 6:01, the deal is off. They want you there at 6 o'clock. If you're not there by 6 o'clock, then the deal is off. So when I left the office that day, it was probably about 4 o'clock that afternoon, 3 o'clock. I had 3 hours to do what I need to do. I said, wait a minute. I said, you can't want me to go tonight. It was like, yeah, you got to be there tonight. I was like, but I got, you know, business to take care of. I got loose ends. He said, Smitty, everything you own is in your pocket. You can be there at 6 o'clock tonight. So I remember making a phone call, and I called my brother and I called some other friends. I said, listen, I got to go to this place at 6 o'clock. Can we get a party together in a couple of hours? They were like, yeah, you know. And so we did. And I remember, I think my brother and somebody else drove me out here that night. But as a matter of fact, one guy that drove me out here is in this room right now. And we parked right in the parking lot, you know, just inside the, you know, the induction center down the hill there. And we finished off some cocaine. We finished off some pot. I think I had a bottle of something. And when I walked into the induction center, I was in a blackout. And I don't remember much of anything, but I was here at 6 o'clock. I do remember that. And I went in, and, you know, they take your picture. I don't know if they still do that when you come in, but they took my picture. And she said the lady who I was dealing with was very nice, you know, kind of older lady, and she was just so peaceful and calm. And I was drunk, and I think I fell out of the chair while she was standing there talking to me. And she said, sir, are you going to need some assistance? I told her, no, ma'am, I have insurance. Thank you. I'm good. So when I came out of my blackout, it was a couple days later. And it was three something in the morning. There was this huge, tremendous white guy. Know he played football somewhere at some point in time. And he was snatching my arm out of my bed with a flashlight, saying he needed to take my vitals. Now, at that time, I didn't know what my vitals were. But I know at 3:30 in the morning, I didn't want him taking them. That's for sure. And I remember coming to, and then we had this itinerary of stuff we had to do. There were classes we had to attend here. There were counseling sessions. And I saw this funny-looking little guy who was always seemed to be at work. I said, does this guy ever go home? Because this guy's always here. And they said, oh, that's Sam. I said, well, every time I'm here, he's here. This guy, is he here? And he's walking through, and he looked mean and crusty and... You know, and somebody said, well, he's a really nice guy. I said, well, somebody should, he should tell his face because I don't see it, you know. And I remember the first counseling session we went in, you know, and they were telling me why I drank. They were telling me why I did cocaine, and they were telling me about all these childhood issues that I had that I didn't even know about. And they were telling me about all this stuff that was going on with me and how my childhood was this and how I came from this, you know, this DNA from all these drunks in my family, you know. And so I learned a lot of stuff, and they gave me a book. They gave me two books. They gave me a Narcotics Anonymous textbook, and they gave me what they called a big book. But it wasn't big, it was a little book. I said, why are they calling this little blue book a big book? He said, you're gonna learn that in due time, don't worry about it. He said, it's gonna wind up being one of the most incredible books you've ever read. And I was like, okay. So I read it that night. I wasn't impressed, you know. I was there for Thanksgiving that year. I was in the treatment center for Thanksgiving. And I remember Lisa coming out to see me. Lisa and I were dating at the time, and I knew she was gonna leave me. It was just a matter of time. And I was okay with that. I knew she had better things to do with her life, and you know, and there I was, a drunk and a junkie, and she was in school, and she was doing some big things, and I knew I wasn't gonna be part of her life for very long. But I was gonna make a doggone good effort, you know. And we start going to the counseling sessions. We had these family, they had to bring my mom and my dad out here and talk about why I was such a snot, you know. And do they still have snot meetings out here? And so I had to come out here, and we all talked, and my family was just incredibly supportive, and, you know, we talked about some issues that we'd had, you know, in our family and how I impacted our family, but I had no idea my using had done what it did to my family, because it created a chasm in my family that I just didn't quite understand the dynamics of it at the time. And my, you know, my mother shared some things that she'd never, you know, told me. My dad shared some things with me about his past, and you know, I don't know what things kind of start coming together. And you know, whether you understand or subscribe to the idea of the God of your understanding, I do today. And I know God started working some things together for me that time, far beyond my ability to understand or see it, that still hold true for me today. And so what I saw as an intrusion on my life was actually the hand of God just kind of stirring things up and mixing things up, and he would put a little of this in it, a little of that in it. And so just about a few days before Christmas, the staff told me that I was going to be going home. And I was very excited. And that was the longest I'd ever gone without using for a lot of years. I started smoking pot when I was 12 years old, and I don't think I had too many clean days from 12 to the time I walked into Ridgeview at 28 years old. And so for that 26, 27 days that I've been in treatment, it was just amazing. I mean, you know, the first thing I noticed is I was kind of thinking a little better, I guess. I certainly was looking a little better, because that picture that I took coming in here, it's amazing how I looked so different from that person 26 days in here. And I was participating in the counseling sessions that were going on. We were attending outside AA meetings, and I was kind of starting to understand what the person told me about that little big book. Because I start reading things in about it. There's a section in the big book called More About Alcoholism. There's a section in the big book that talks about me as an alcoholic, and it described me to a T, and I just couldn't believe it. And I read something in that book about how that book describes us with masterly detail. And no one had ever described me like that before. And I read through that book, and I went to a big book study, and you know, I was getting all this information. Some of it I understood, some of it I didn't, some of it I subscribed to, most of it I did not. But they told me that was gonna come too. And so just a couple days before I was released, I had an intervention with the staff, and they felt like I wasn't being sincere enough about my recovery. They say, we think you're skating. We need you to get a little bit more serious about your recovery. And they said, and one guy even told me, he said, we think you laugh too much. And I was like, me? And they say, yeah, so we think we're going to extend your time here another week. And I have never had a smile go from my face so quickly. And I told them, I said, no. I said, no, I have to leave. I can't be here any longer. I have to leave. And, you know, I met with my, you know, my counselor and my doctor, and they agreed if I made some commitments, then they will let me go. But what they were suggesting was I commit to going to a halfway house. I said, what's a halfway house? He said, well, it's a halfway point between here and you going back to your home environment. And it's a place where you can partner with some guys in a residence, and you all be living together. I said, hey. I said, hold up. I'll be living where? They say, well, we've got a little apartment complex, and you'll be living with three other guys. I say, it ain't gonna happen, man. And I say, well, this is a suggestion that the staff is making for your successful transition back into society. Well, I had my own ideas about my own transition back into society, and it did not include living with four guys, you know. So they gave me an alternative of going to an outpatient place 4 nights a week. On the fifth night, I had to make an AA meeting. I said, that's a much better situation for me. That was the start of some really incredible things. I started going to what was at that time called the Ridgeview Recovery Center. And, you know, we had intense meetings, we had therapy sessions, we had AA meetings, and that's where I really started to understand why I use, you know, what it was doing for me, what it wasn't doing for me, and I started to get it. And I started meeting some incredible men and women. That's when I got my first sponsor. They told me I needed to get a sponsor. I said, okay, now how do I do that? They said, well, you find somebody you like, or you see something they have that you want, and you ask them to be your sponsor. Well, my first sponsor, I chose him because he drove a Porsche convertible. He had what I wanted. Well, shortly after, that guy got arrested because he was selling stolen goods out of his Porsche convertible. So I learned how to better start selecting a sponsor, and I found a guy who was really patient and kind, and he understood, and he did the same kind of drugs I did. We frequented the same west side of Atlanta pharmaceutical houses, and we began to forge a relationship, and he introduced me at that time to Narcotics Anonymous, and I started attending a lot of Narcotics Anonymous meetings on the west side of town, and that's when I found out about the other fellowships, and so in addition to my AA meetings, I was going to meetings and other fellowships as well, and I found out that recovery is recovery, man, you know, and you got to find the spot that works for you. And that's what I did. I got involved, man. And Lisa and I think I asked Lisa to marry me like 3 or 4 times that week. And she kept saying no, man. She said, well, you know, your counselors say that you should make any major changes in your life for a year. I said, what do they know? But I was afraid of losing her. And I figured if I got her tied up or I tricked her into marrying me, then she'd have to go along for the ride. You know, she said, dude, I'm not going anywhere. But I need you to get this recovery foundation down. If you're going to be with me, we can't do it with the way you've been living. You know, so there has to be a change, and I think this is going to be the way. And so we jumped into it with both feet, man, and the most incredible things started happening. I started meeting guys, and I started getting involved. I started doing service work. I started working the steps. I actually started working the steps. I didn't know at the time what that was going to do, but some living principles started being introduced into my life. And see, I was an unprincipled guy. I didn't have any standards, and the ones that I had were very low. And I started learning how to navigate through life without using. I started to learn how to deal with situations without having that buffer of my drugs. And, you know, I medicated, and everything I did, I medicated, man. And I remember my first sponsor told me, he said, you're going to be surprised here in a little while because you're going to start experiencing things for the first time, clean and sober, that you used to do all the time high, and it's going to be like you're experiencing them for the first time. And he was right, man. I mean, I started doing things, and Lisa used to have these incredible functions at work where they would have these incredible parties, and we had gone to those parties for years, and I would always go, and I'd always embarrass her because they had a room, and there was a bar in the corner of every room. And I would go to those functions, and Lisa always knew where she could find me because I'd go park myself at one of those bars, and I would sit there for the rest of the night, and I'd get sloppy drunk, and I would embarrass her, and I'd say things and do things, and then I'd demand that she let me drive home. And we did that for years, and I remember that when I came out and the first time we went back to one of those events, It was like a movie, you know. I remember she was like, "You sure you want to go to this?" I said, "Yeah." I talked to my sponsor, and I've been talking about this party, and you know, I've been doing one of my meetings. I said, "Yeah, I want to go." She said, "Cause you don't have to go," and I was like, "No, I want to go." And so we went to the meeting, and we were having fun, and we hang out. And I saw the bars in the corner room where I used to go hang out, and I was doing okay. Till some guy started walking to me with a tray full of champagne flutes. And I'll never forget it. Everything started going in slow motion at that time. I was sitting down, I saw him coming toward me. And he would turn and he had the champagne flutes and he said, "Champagne, sir." And I said, "No, thank you." And he turned around and walked away. And I knew at that moment, man, I was going to be okay. I knew I was going to be okay. Lisa came and checked on me a couple times, and I had the Sprite and the lemon and the Sprite and all that kind of stuff, man. But I knew that things were going to be different from that point on. And I got involved with service work, man. My sponsor told me, you know, it's about time for you to start sponsoring people. I said, what? How am I going to sponsor somebody? He said, well, you got a lot to give somebody, man. He said, people need to know what you did and how you did it because you're staying sober. You know, you got almost a year and a half sober now. I was like, wow, that is a trip, man. And that was a miracle. But guys, you know, the real miracle was that at that time, not that I wasn't drinking, but it was the fact that I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to do any cocaine. I didn't want to get high. That was the miracle. And I wish I could say I did all the right things at the right times. I wish I could say I did it all great. But the program is serious, man. It's life-changing, but it's also very forgiving. And I made some bonehead decisions clean and sober. I got into some crazy situations clean and sober, but I didn't have to drink. I didn't have to use. Lisa and I got married almost 2 years. I had almost 2 years sober. And Lisa and I got married, and we had the most incredible wedding, man. And I'll never forget, you know, a lot of my recovery friends were there just in case I bolted, you know, and they, and things were just really coming together. And, you know, Lisa and I jumped in and we were going to meetings and we were participating in all kind of stuff. And I think Lisa went to, I think Lisa may have gone to a couple of Al-Anon meetings or something like that. But she had her own relationship with God at the time, man, and that was sustaining her. And it was also supporting me. And I also learned about this relationship with God. And, you know, the God of my understanding today is certainly not the God of my upbringing. And I forged a relationship with him. And today, that is the most important relationship in my life today. Because without that one, I can't be there for Lisa. I can't be there for you guys. I can't be there for the son. We have a son, Austin, just finished his first year of college. And he's never seen me drunk a day in his life. And it's just amazing because when he was a baby, man, we put that joker in the chair and we'd go to meetings and he'd cry and I'd stick a ball in his mouth and I'd cry and Lisa stick a ball in my mouth, you know. So we kind of grew up in these rooms, you know, and we forged relationships and we forged friendships. And I don't sit here today to try to twist anybody's arm about how wonderful recovery is. That's something you got to find out for yourself. But I know the misery I lived. I know the hell I went through. I know the chaos I caused in people's lives today. And God used this particular venue to bring it all back together for me. I know these places and these rooms don't have a monopoly on people getting clean and sober, but this is the way that worked for most of us. And this is the way I want to continue to live. We got some wonderful things going on in our lives today, just like anybody else. We live life on life's terms, man. Stuff happens, and you know, since I've been sober, man, I lost my parents, I lost a brother, a grand. I mean, you know, it's just the transitions of life, man. It's a cycle of life. But what I did for most of my life is that when something happened, good, bad, or indifferent, I used over it. And the day I don't have to do that, the day I learned that recovery had an answer to my issues. And I subscribed to the principles behind the 12 steps. And they gave me a guideline and a roadmap for living today the way I live. Now, somebody looking inside my window may not see a whole lot. But I tell you, man, I'm living a life today beyond my wildest imaginations. Perfect? No. But good? Yeah, man. Really, really good. And I have a lot of fun in recovery, and I insist on it. I insist on having fun. People who get in recovery and don't have fun, man, they're missing out, aren't they, Paul?
Oh, yeah.
They're missing out, man. Aren't they, Tom?
Absolutely.
Missing out, man. Perry, are they missing out? See? And so, again, you know, I didn't get clean to have fun. I got clean so I could live because I was killing myself. But I found a way, or God found a way for me to merge the two, man. I could live a good life and have a good time doing it, you know, that I wouldn't have to depend on that crutch that I had for so incredibly long. And I'm very, very, very grateful, man. And I am very serious about my recovery, but I have a lot of fun in it. I'll never forget the first time we had left a meeting one night with Austin. He was a little boy at the time, and we went to a restaurant, and it was kind of an upscale restaurant. And so the waitress came over, and she said, well, she started explaining all the margarita drinks and had, all the stuff that they had, you know, the drink specials they had. And Austin said, my daddy don't drink. He's an alcoholic. So you try explaining the spirit of anonymity to an eight-year-old and tell him, you know. But we've had those kind of incidents. We were at Bible study one night at church one night, and you know, at the end of our Bible study, we stand and hold hands and we do the Lord's Prayer. And so we did the Lord's Prayer, and after we said the Lord's Prayer, Austin said, keep coming back. It works if you work it. But we laugh and we kid, but that's the kind of invasiveness that this recovery process has on your life, if you let it. You know, it'll infiltrate every part of your life, man, and it'll make the bad days not so bad, and it'll make the good days, like Austin said, even gooder, you know. And so I'm very grateful today, and I'm very thankful. I'm so proud of the Ridgeview Alumni Association, man, for the weekend that you guys put on every year. Whether people tell you or not, man, they're blessed by it, they're encouraged by it, and it's a lot of fun. Lisa and I, for years, man, we came up here to the New Year's Eve party, and man, we used to have such a great time, and for me not to be drinking, bringing in the new year was just pretty strange, you know what I'm saying? I always had a bottle of something or a snort of something bringing in the new year, and the fact that I brought in the new year the first couple years, you know, that I was sober here in this place was just absolutely amazing. And I remember dancing with Tom and Patty Scott, man. I remember just us just up here just having a great time. And, you know, all those memories just came flooding in, you know, when we walked up here tonight. And I'm very grateful and very thankful. And recovery is a serious business, man. It's a very serious business. Some of us owe our lives to this process. And the recovering community is a large one, but you have to go and avail yourself of it. You know, it's not like Domino's Pizza. It doesn't deliver. You got to go get it. And I'm very, very grateful for the steps. I'm grateful for the sponsorship. I'm grateful for all the sponsees. I'm grateful for my family today who has just been incredibly supportive. I got a few guys in here right now sponsored and you know, and so it's just a, you know, it's a community, man, and that's what we do. And you know, and I'm just very grateful, man. I'm so thankful. For anybody who would have told me years ago that I'd be almost 26 years without taking a drink, man, it's just beyond my ability to even comprehend and take that in. But that's what God does, man, when you let him do it. He does some incredible things for all of us. And so I just pray that everybody has a very slow recovery. Everybody has a very patient recovery. And just know, man, there's a lot in store for you. And I know we're people in this room, we're at different points in our recovery. There are probably some people in here with a couple weeks clean. There are probably some people like Sam with 200 years clean, you know. And so my home group is the Heavy Hitters group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we meet at the Serenity Club on Moreland Avenue. We're across the street from the only drive-in that still operates in the city of Atlanta. And that clubhouse today is a restored liquor store. Absolutely amazing, man. And so I'm very grateful today that I get to participate, you know, in such a way. God has a way of bringing things full circle, and he certainly has brought me full circle. I'm very grateful to have an opportunity to come and speak tonight. Thank you guys for asking me, and I love you, and just get another day. Thank you.